Hi, everybody. I'm Karen Hartglass. You're listening to It's All About Food. Can you hear it? Can you hear that tone in my voice? That scratchy, nasally plugged sound? Yep. I got a cold. A few days ago, Gary and I were both hit with really bad colds. He got it a day before me, or at least started showing the symptoms a day before me. We might have contacted it about the same time. You can never really know where you get your colds from. There are all kinds of theories about where the germs and bugs come from. Here we're in New York, and it's been particularly hot. We've been enjoying the heat, actually, doing a lot of sweating. And then we actually broke down and turned on the AC. And it was around that time, I think, that the symptoms started to occur. So I wonder, is it because of the change in atmosphere? Is it maybe some bug that was lurking in the filter of our air conditioning system? Maybe it was a combination of many things. But all I know is we have paid the price. The good thing is, today I got up and I'm actually feeling like I got over the peak. And that's why I'm able to talk to you today. The other good thing about getting sick is when you get better. And it's funny sometimes. It's like, you know, banging your head against the wall. You feel this pain when you bang the head against the wall, and then someone will say, well, don't bang your head against the wall. Not that I'm volunteering getting an illness, but when it's getting better and when you're getting over it and you're feeling relief, it's easy to forget how good you feel, and it's easy to forget how bad you felt. So if you're feeling good, appreciate that feeling. Try and think about how good it feels to not feel anything or not feel any discomfort or pain or stuffiness or low energy. And if you do have symptoms from one thing or another, and who doesn't? We all experience different things in our lives. I hope you find some relief. If it's something in particular that you're curious about, you can send me an email. Perhaps I can send you some resources that would be helpful. I would like everybody to feel good, have energy, no aches and pains, sniffles, scratchy throat, foggy brain, all of that stuff. Really unpleasant. Really unpleasant. Feeling good feels good. While Gary and I were in California in June and July and early August working with two casts, directing them into the woods, we were very vigilant about staying well, especially being exposed to so many different people in a close environment. And we dropped our guard. Traveling on the subway here in New York City cannot be good. This is a great place to pick up all kinds of germs and things, touching the handrails and breathing the air that is shared by so many. So, it's a reminder to me and a reminder to those who are listening about how we can't wash our hands enough and to be careful about where you're breathing, and if you sneeze or cough, to cover yourself so that you don't share what you have with other people. But sometimes getting sick can actually be helpful. It's sort of like a recharge or a reboot of the immune system a little bit, just to get it in action. But it's a pretty painful process. We are not big television watchers, and if we watch anything at home, it's typically movies. And when I get a cold like this, it's an opportunity to sit back and relax and watch films. So we watched a bunch of cartoons, the Disney cartoons, and some others, Pixar, some light, I want to say mindless, but not so mindless, and some old movies that we knew were funny, which helped pass the time. And I often ask myself, is getting an illness, getting a flu or a cold, a clue to the body to rest? It's almost like when you're pushing, and you don't take time to really relax and get good rest, the body just, the immune system drops and you get sick. Basically what happened is we got through our major event of the summer, then came back home to New York and had a few other big events in the family. And when everything was over, we got a cold. The body said, okay, now we can relax, right? Boom, get in bed. It's hard too when everybody in the house is sick. Who's going to be the caretaker? And we've been taking turns. There seems to have been different parts of the day when one felt worse than the other. And I found that I would get little bursts of energy where I could do things and then kind of collapse again in bed. But the key, you've heard it all before, the key is to hydrate, and to rest. And once you've fallen, there's not a whole lot that you can do to turn it around. All you can do is try and make yourself feel as comfortable as possible and be able to get the rest that you need so your body can recover. The first thing that I did when I was feeling really crummy is I made a quick soup, kind of like the chicken soup variety, but of course I'm not using chicken soup. We had some carrots and celery already chopped in the refrigerator, and I put that in a pot with some cooked potatoes, which we already had, red cooked potatoes. I chopped them up. We already had some cooked garbanzo beans, and I put them in a soup pot with a lot of water, added some onion powder, garlic powder, turmeric, some herbs, and made a quick chickenless brothy soup, which was really helpful. I wasn't very hungry, but this was something that could keep me hydrated, give me some nourishment, and keep me going. I'll tell you where I'd like to be right now with this cold. Dr. Furman has a new retreat. It's called the Eat to Live Retreat, and it's just opening this month in September. It's set in San Diego. I've seen the pictures. It's really a gorgeous spot on some lovely property, and you relax there, you can exercise, you can be seen by Dr. Furman and his assistants. I'm imagining the meals are fabulous. And the purpose of it is to have a place to go to be nourished in both mind and body. And you can take the steps you need to journey towards a healthier life. It's expensive. It's about $11,000 a month, and depending on your health situation, some insurance plans may cover some of it. The ideal stay is 4 to 12 weeks, which can get very expensive. But for people that are in a serious health crisis and can't find a way to transform their life and learn how to eat better, this may be a lifeline. So I'm mentioning it to you, if you know of anybody that might be interested in the Eat to Live retreat, which is just opening this month. If you want more information, I can send you a brochure. You can contact me at info@realmeals.org. But while I'm sitting here feeling kind of crummy, I'm thinking of that space and how beautiful it is, and having people make me my delicious, nourishing, healing meals, and it sounds pretty good. Coming back to Something we spoke about on the show last week, Gary and I were going off that evening last Tuesday to see the New York premiere of a new documentary called The End of Meat. And while I celebrate and appreciate any opportunity for filmmakers to get the message out about the importance of eating plants and the importance of not eating meat for all the reasons, I'm going to confess that I was disappointed with the film. It's not easy making a film. It's not easy raising money to make films. But I think the most important thing is to tell a story. And we weren't really sure what the story was in this film. It was kind of all over the place, and it moved very slowly. So unfortunately, I don't think this is a piece that will make a big difference. I don't think it'll get a splash. I don't think it will transform the lives of many people. And that is unfortunate, because the motivation, the incentive, the inspiration was there. Another part of it that was frustrating to me was the fact, and this was just the filmmaker exposing it, not necessarily supporting it, but all of the investment that is going into making cultured meat. Personally, I think it's sick. You can quote me on it. There is so much money and technology going into making animal flesh in a factory rather than growing animals. Now, this is great in that the development of this concept will reduce or even eliminate animals being grown for food. I get that. I support that. Anything to eliminate or at least reduce significantly the pain and suffering of all of the innocent beings that show up slaughtered on our plates and used for other things like vivisection and who knows all the other things that we exploit animals for. But do we really need cultured meat? I mean, what is it in the human psyche that says, I need my meat? It's a sickness. There are wonderful foods on the planet, in the plant kingdom, that are delicious, nutritious, more nutritious, and satisfying. Why can't we make that jump, that leap? Where is it that we were programmed to feel that we have to have our meat? We have to have it. To the point where we're investing all of this time and using brilliant scientists to create meat in factories. It's sick. It's sick. And this was a point in the film. In fact, there was a farmer who even said that I can't quote him because I only saw the film once, but it was something about how he couldn't give up. And he knew that eating plant foods was probably healthier, but he wanted to have his meat. It reminded me of when I was on the panel, gosh, it was about 5 years ago or so, when I was invited on a panel to speak about animal agriculture's impact on climate change, and it took place at a woman's feedlot. Actually, she was hosting an event near her feedlot in Nevada, and it was the day before she had a bull sale. And she always liked having educational events, and so this time she wanted to have a talk about climate change, and she wanted a vegan on the panel. It's a great story. If you haven't heard it, you might want to see the documentary film we created with zero budget. And we created the film after the fact, so we probably could have planned it better had we thought going into the event that we were going to make a film about it, but we really didn't know what was going to happen. And it was kind of a scary experience, actually, for a vegan going into the mouth of the wolves. We call the film The Lone Vegan, Preaching to the Fire. But there was one panelist from the University of California at Davis, Frank Mitlooner. And he got to a point where he was a little obsessed about wanting his meat, the same as the guy in the film where they just can't live without their meat. They can't see past the idea of not eating meat. It's almost an obsession. It is an obsession, like a sickness. What I'm saying is the reasons for wanting and eating meat coming from some of these people did not seem rational. There we go. Didn't seem rational. If you're interested at all in seeing the Lone Vegan Preaching to the Fire, I just want you to know it's free and it's available at responsibleeatingandliving.com/lonevegan.htm. Or you could just Google Lone Vegan and you can see it on YouTube. There's another documentary that I would like to see called Dominion, and it just came out about a month ago. It's an Australian film. If you go to dominionmovement.com, you can rent it for 99 cents. You can buy it for $4.95. So I think it's a reasonable price to check it out. And they talk about humans' dominion over the animal kingdom, mainly focusing on animals used for food. And I'm curious about it. I heard some good things about it when it was being made, and I hope it's a good film that's going to make a lot of positive change. If you've seen it, let me know. Send me an email at info@realmeals.org. You can also tell me what some of your favorite films were on this subject. Was there a film that you watched that changed your life? Maybe the Forks Over Knives documentary or Earthlings or something like that. What did it for you? I'm curious. For a long time, the only video we had back in the early 90s was Diet for a New America, the PBS film based on John Robbins' best-selling book of the same title, Diet for a New America. And watching it now, it still has a very good message, but the technology is nowhere near where it is today, so viewing it might be a little difficult. But you can watch that on YouTube too. I believe many people have uploaded it to watch. Unfortunately, not much has changed. It's only gotten worse. Another film I'm looking forward to, it's not out yet, is Code Blue. If you listened to my interview last year with Dr. Saray Stancic, she is a medical doctor who had multiple sclerosis and turned her disease around significantly with diet, and she's doing a film about it. It's a great story, great information, something that needs to get out there because so many people are suffering unnecessarily with autoimmune diseases like multiple sclerosis, and many can find relief with diet. I'm not saying that it is a cure-all for everyone, but diet can make a significant improvement, a significant difference. And the important thing, of course, is to eat whole, minimally processed plant foods, eliminate the junk food, the sugar, the processed white flour foods, cookies, cakes, breads, pastas. And the most important thing is to eat those really nutritious foods, the greens, broccoli and kale and collards, the cruciferous vegetables, cauliflower. Load up on mushrooms, onions, garlic, beans. I love those beans. And berries and nuts and seeds. These foods are delicious. And wow, they can do so many positive things for all of us. You know, I don't think I finished tying up why I had a problem with the major investment and research into making cultured meats. Here's the thing. That time, that money, that intelligence could be put into things that I think are a little more meaningful, that have a greater need, which is curing diseases that we have no clue about what the cause is. I'm not even talking about research for heart disease or diabetes or some cancers, because we know what causes them. It's diet and lifestyle. But maybe for the cancers that we don't know what causes them, and maybe some of the more obscure neurological diseases, Gary and I went to a fundraiser a couple of weeks ago, somebody that Gary's worked with an actor, has a daughter who has this obscure neurological disease, and they did a play reading for it that we attended and supported. And these are the things that need the time, the money, the research. Do we really need to be putting all of our intelligence and time and money and research into making cultured meat so that people can have their meat? We have black bean burgers. We even have the Impossible Burger and the Beyond Burger, and those still, I wish people would eat more whole foods rather than have to have a processed burger like a Beyond Burger or an Impossible Burger. But at least these are made from food and aren't requiring the amount of research and investment like cultured meat. And the Beyond Burger and the Impossible Burger can also be made healthier than animal flesh because it's made from plants. They're both made from plants. And here's another thing. We could be investing money that's going into cultured meat, for example, and other sorts of high-tech concepts that really aren't going to bring benefit to humanity and society, and invest in people. For example, a couple of months ago, the USDA put out a report, child poverty heavily concentrated in rural Mississippi, even more so than before the Great Recession. This is a very sad story. It's a sad story for the United States, a rich nation. It's a sad story all over the world when we hear about child poverty. Child poverty connects to many problems in society, and the children that are often raised in poverty have all kinds of problems that continue throughout their adult lives. It affects their ability to learn when they live in poverty because they're not nourished properly, they're not raised properly, their education may be problematic, some may not go to school as often, they may not be going to good schools, they may get sick more often. There's all kinds of issues related to child poverty, emotional issues. The sad thing is, according to this report, it's sad, period, but the sad thing is it's not getting better, it's worse. The report opens up telling us that according to estimates by the U.S. Census Bureau Americans Community Survey, nearly 20% of children were living in poverty in 2016, compared with 18% in 2007. There are all kinds of reasons for this, but it's a societal problem, it's a cultural problem. Poverty, lack of opportunity, continues because of racial discrimination, ethnic discrimination, as well as a number of different phenomena that you tend to find in rural counties where a lot of the persistent poverty exists. And that's physical isolation, exploitation of resources, limited assets and economic opportunities, and an overall lack of human and social capital. Poverty results in food problems, nutrition problems. Nutrition problems lead to behavioral problems and an inability to learn and grow the best way you possibly can. The biggest problem seems to be in Mississippi. They have the greatest concentration of rural child poverty. And I remember back in around 2004, 2005 timeframe when I was working for the nonprofit EarthSave, we were throwing around the idea of having a health march in Mississippi because we knew that Mississippi was the sickest state, sickest. And we wanted to have a big opportunity to reach the masses and educate them about healthy diet. We never did it. It was a nice idea, but it didn't happen. But Mississippi is still the most problematic places, but the problem is everywhere. I remember as a young teenager, I think I was around 12 or 13, thinking about poverty and starvation and food insecurity. And I didn't understand it. I still don't understand it, but I didn't understand it then. I didn't understand how it could happen and how, as a society, we could allow it to happen. Now I have a better understanding, not that I clearly understand why people make the choices they do, but we can understand how it happens. We can understand how the distribution of wealth and the ever-widening gap in wealth can make a tremendous difference between those who have and those who have not. And it leads to many things, including child poverty. And it's not like we don't have the means. It's not like we don't have the answers. We do. I want to highlight a new report that just came out. It's the Spotlight on Sustainable Development 2018, Exploring New Policy Pathways, How to Overcome Obstacles and Contradictions, and the Implementation of the 2030 Agenda. It's a report by the Civil Society Reflection Group on the 2030 Agenda for Sustainable Development. You may or may not remember that the 2030 Agenda for Sustainable Development was adopted by world leaders in September of 2015 at a historic UN summit. And it officially came into force in early 2016. And it has many new goals, which over the next 15 years, well, it's less than 15 years now, 2030, 12 years, are supposed to end all forms of poverty, fight inequalities, tackle climate change, and ensure that no one is left behind. Very, very ambitious goals. So this new report that has come out is evaluating where we are in terms of meeting those goals, what the obstacles are, what the contradictions are, and how we might implement some of them, or at least move closer to those goals. You can find the report at 2030spotlight.org. You can download a PDF. I recommend reading it. I recommend sharing it. I recommend discussing it with your family, your friends, your school, your social communities, wherever you might go. This conversation we all need to be having. They've already put out two prior reports in 2016 and 2017. And now we have one for 2018. Not all of the report is related to food. There are some chapters that are specifically connected to food. I'm going to highlight them briefly. Chapter 1 talks about the increasing concentration of wealth and economic power as an obstacle to sustainable development and what to do about it. This certainly impacts food and food security. This chapter is by Kate Donald, the Center for Economic and Social Rights, and Jens Martens, Global Policy Forum. And they open in the second paragraph saying that a major part of the inequality picture is increasing market concentration and the accumulation of wealth and economic power in the hands of a relatively small number of transnational corporations and ultra-rich individuals. Intense concentration of wealth and power is, in fact, inimical to progress across the entire 2030 agenda. Yeah. They also say that this sustained, inclusive, and sustainable economic growth will only be possible if wealth is shared and income inequality is addressed. That's big. And we know this. The question is, how do we get out of this loop that we're in, this framework that has made up our society where the rich get richer and the poor get poorer? The chapter goes into great detail about this issue, and they talk about how there are alternatives, and I will highlight some of them. They say governments urgently need to implement fiscal and regulatory policies which respond to the massive accumulation of individual wealth and to generate and redistribute resources in a way more aligned with human rights principles and standards, including through the provision of quality public services accessible to all. That's a mouthful. And it sure sounds nice in a report. And a lot of intelligent people came together to say statements like this. The problem, as you well know, and I well know, is that our government leaders, especially the ones who are currently in control here in the United States, do not believe this. They want to keep the wealth amongst those who have it. So what can we do as people? We need to vote. We need to vote out the people that don't represent what we need. And we need to support candidates who are coming from out of nowhere that have great passion and really believe in this concept of redistributing resources that are more aligned with human rights principles and standards. So this is on us. There are things that we can do. Speaking of which, I recently went to a training program to be an election worker. So when the elections come up, primaries and the national election coming up in November, I may be working amongst the other election workers. There are a variety of different things that election workers do. But there was something that was really amazing to me about the training program. Unfortunately, I think this is only true to election training in maybe New York City or maybe the state of New York. I'm not sure. But I don't think it is true around the United States. And it may even be better in other cities or states. I don't know. But what I loved about the opening of the training was it continually told the workers that they needed to treat everyone with respect and they needed to be mindful of the needs that voters had. There's a sense of not just respect, but politeness and integrity. And this kind of training that opened the beginning of our training book and our training presentation is something that can be included in everything. All government officials need to have this kind of training. All educators need to have this training. All students need to have this training. All people in society need to have this training. It was like, wow, an eye-opener for me. And if we could educate everyone to treat people right away from the get-go with this amount of respect and mindfulness that we're all coming from different places, we all have different needs, and we all want to be helpful, the world could be a lot better place. There were some videos that we watched how election workers could be more helpful to people with hearing disabilities or vision disabilities, and how we assume that people can hear, how we assume people can see. And we really should be mindful and paying attention all the time when we connect people. One of the recommendations was to look the other person in the eye. This is profound. But the point is, we'll have more success in everything we do when we look at people, when we communicate with people eye to eye, see what their needs are, see what their thoughts are, see what their feelings are. Okay, back to this spotlight report. The second chapter I wanted to bring out is chapter 2, policies that strengthen the nexus between food, health, ecology, livelihoods, and identities. It's by Stefano Prado, the Society for International Development, Elenita Daño and Trudy Zuntel of the ETC Group, Lim Lee Ching and Chi Yok Ling Third World Network. And they acknowledge that food is at the core of the nexus between identities, health, ecology, and livelihoods, an intrinsic space where different important dimensions of life converge. I'm reading the opening of the chapter. Yet policy discussions and deliberations that impact on food and food systems are often fragmented and incoherent, and this chapter explores the close connection between these different domains and offers feasible pathways on how to place the virtuous interplay between sustainable and diversified local food systems and healthy diets at the core of public policy agenda. Well, that's a big mouthful, because to begin with, we need to have healthy diets and diversified sustainable food systems at the core of public policy agenda. And it's not. It simply isn't. But we need to demand it. We need to demand it loudly. And to start at a local level, because the local level is where it's at. The local level is what controls our local community spaces, the little parks and things where we can build on more community farms, for example. It's the local level, for the most part, that determines the laws about our local communities, what we can grow. Can we have a garden on our front lawn, for example? There are some communities that don't allow people to have gardens on their front lawn. Food gardens, I mean, not floral gardens. Some communities don't want you growing food, which is just ludicrous. Towards the end of the chapter, there are some things that I really liked that were brought out. For example, they say that there needs to be a rethinking of how food policy is made to be more inclusive and to encourage people to re-engage with the politics of food. In other words, there is a need for people to change their relationship to food systems more fundamentally, to shift from being consumers to being citizens. Our government considers us consumers. Our government does not consider us as citizens. We need to take that back. We need to turn that around. We need to be considered as citizens with needs and rights, and all to be treated equally with equal opportunities. We are not consumers. When we're considered as consumers, our needs will not be met. They continue saying, as citizens start to actively shape what the future of their food and agricultural systems look like, they reassert themselves as legitimate players in the policies that determine the food they eat. This is food democracy. I love that. This report also says that unfortunately, technology is making matters worse, as the required paradigm shift points at the opposite direction than the powerful technological drivers of change currently at play. Three intertwined dynamics, digitalization, and financialization, are profoundly changing the nature of both tradable goods and the markets where these are exchanged. When talking about dematerialization, they talk about how the food price is impacted by so many things: transport, logistics, distribution costs. There's also advertising, financial remunerations to investors. There's also the fashion and tastes, where aggressive marketing and new food fashions are generating an immaterial notion of food that is unrelated to its physical qualities. In the section about the digitalization of food, there have been benefits to the digitalization of food, but it seems to be overwhelmingly taken over or captured by the global corporations aiming to patent nature and acquire control of the production process by controlling the market in agricultural inputs. So plant and breed varieties circulating around the globe in form of patented genetic data, while the physical exchange of real seeds is made illegal in some countries. So this idea that certain seeds are patented and cannot be freely shared is a serious problem. It's a good chapter. I recommend reading the whole thing. I recommend reading the entire report. Just highlighting a few other chapters, there is SCG 12, Curbing the Consumption of Ultra-Processed Foods and Beverages, Critical to Achieving SDG 12. So there were clearly numbered outline goals in the Sustainable Development Goals that were announced. And Goal 12, which this chapter is referring to, is about ensuring sustainable consumption and production patterns, promoting resource and energy efficiency, sustainable infrastructure, and providing access to basic services, green and decent jobs, and a better quality of life for all. Its implementation helps to achieve overall development plans, reduce future economic, environmental, and social costs, strengthen economic competitiveness, and reduce poverty. I think we all understand the importance of reducing the consumption of sugary beverages and other junk foods, ultra-processed foods, in order to achieve better health. What this chapter talks about is that in order for these policies to effectively contribute to achieving the SDG 12, it is critical that they are statutory and not self-regulatory, the latter of which have proven ineffective as they are developed by the industries that they seek to regulate. Furthermore, the design, implementation, and evaluation of these policies must be free of conflicts of interest from large-scale food and beverage corporations. Yes, another big mouthful, easier said than done, and it gets back to getting officials that represent us appropriately in government. We need more representatives who understand the importance of making food security, making health priorities. There's also a chapter on sustainable fishery or blue economy is what it's called, sustainable fishery or blue economy, and it is talking about the Sustainable Development Goal 14, which is sustainable use of the oceans, conservation of the oceans. And I'm bringing this chapter up, not that I support fishing, because as a vegan, I don't think we should be consuming fish. I love the film Finding Nemo, where they say fish are your friends, not food. I believe that. There's more and more evidence about how fish, not only can they feel pain, but they have a tremendous intelligence that we're just beginning to recognize and be able to comprehend. When you live in a different environment and you have different needs and your senses operate differently than humans do, it's really hard for us to understand, empathize. It's next to impossible, but slowly we're finding methods. Some of them aren't the nicest methods, but we're finding ways to understand that fish do have incredible intelligence. And I really don't think they should be on our plate, but what I can align with groups that are looking for sustainable fishery is cleaning up the oceans, because our oceans are everybody's toilets these days. And we need to turn that around. So we can align with people who don't necessarily have all of the same goals, but have some similar goals, and we can work together on that, cleaning up the oceans. This particular chapter talks about the rights of indigenous people and small, poor, local fish farming communities that are losing their source of food because of huge fish subsidies that have resulted in overfishing of the oceans and big corporations that overfish, and the policies that we have that do not support sustainable oceans. So I hope you'll have a chance to check out the spotlight in Sustainable Development 2018. There's a lot of good information in here. If you're a parent, maybe your children can write reports and share with their classes and friends and family using some of the information in this report. It's excellent and needs to be shared on all levels. Okay, let's spend the final portion of this program talking about what I really love about food, and that's eating it, eating delicious, nutritious food. I want to take some time to focus on the squashes. Now, a few weeks ago, I talked about zucchini, which is also considered a squash. But the ones I want to talk about today are the ones that are hard on the outside, and the kind that are typically harvested later in the summer and early in the fall. So now's a good time to talk about those squashes, like kombucha squash. This is hard on the outside. It's got a knobby looking skin and it's shaped like a squat pumpkin. It has a dull finish, a deep green skin. Sometimes it has some stripes, white or yellow stripes, and it has an intense yellow color, yellow-orange color on the inside. What I love about it is it has an exceptionally sweet flavor. It's even sweeter than butternut squash, and we can talk about butternut squash too, which is another yummy squash. 'Tis the season for kabocha. It's available all year, but best in late summer and early fall. Now, what made me think about kabocha is Gary and I were out on a vegan cheese finding mission a few days ago. We went over to Riverdale Market in Brooklyn. We did a report on Riverdale in one of our What Vegans Eat posts last year. And it's a great little shop. It has the best of the vegan cheeses available on the market, along with some plant meats, for example. And they also make sandwiches and other foods for you to sample and taste. It's fun taking a trip there. And if you're a tourist in New York City or you live anywhere near New York City, I recommend making a visit to Riverdale. And it's a fun community, too, with lots of restaurants nearby. And that's where I rediscovered kabocha, or was reminded of kabocha, because we went to lunch at Luann's Wild Ginger, which was very near the Riverdale shop. Luann's Wild Ginger has a number of restaurants in New York City, and I've never been to any of them. And I loved it. I loved it because the combination of flavors was very different, very unique. So it was hard to read the menu, actually, because there were lots of different items and I didn't know what any of them would be like, but they were all vegan. You know, that's a funny thing that a number of us have laughed at over the years. When we used to go to restaurants 20, 25 years ago, there weren't many options, and we would have to kind of create a plate from what we saw that was available on the menu, from the vegetables, salads, baked potatoes, things like that. But now there are many vegan restaurants available with many creative menus, and you go and you read a menu and there's just too many choices. It's really hard to understand or really hard to decide. But we did decide, and I ended up getting the kimchi pumpkin gumbo, and it had spiced cabbage, white beans, sweet potato, diced tomato in a kabocha puree, and it was served with multigrains with avocado, fresh basil, mint leaf, and cilantro garnish, and it was fantastic. My tongue was a little confused at first, like, what's this spiced cabbage doing with this sweet kabocha puree? But it was truly yummy. And the kabocha puree, or the kabocha in general, you don't have to do much to it. It's just simply delicious, as most squashes are. So the way that I like to prepare squash is easy. I just rinse the outside, because you don't know where it's been. Well, it's been in the ground, and the people have, it's gone from hand to hand through the distribution process. So I'll wash it. And then I'll put it in a 400 degree oven, just on a sheet pan. I don't cover it or wrap it. I don't cut it open, anything. And I'll cook it for at least an hour. I'll poke a fork in it to see if it's soft. Then carefully, I remove it, carefully open it because it's hot, scoop the seeds out, and then I can slice the flesh out and enjoy it. This way, it's soft when it's time to cut it. I don't really like cutting hard squashes because it's hard, and I find this easier. You, of course, can choose any way you like, but this is the way I recommend it. And then that kabocha squash can be pureed and used as a cream of kabocha soup, and you can put any of your favorite vegetables in it. Or you can just chop it up and serve it warm with other vegetables, with tempeh, tofu, beans, or chop up little chunks and put it in salad. It's just delightful because it's chewy and dense and has a lovely sweet flavor. Not too sweet like a fruit, of course, but sweet and savory at the same time. I just think it's a fantastic food. Another fun thing that can be done with squashes, and you can do it with the kabocha, or you can do it with acorn squash, for example. Now, this you can do the same way or not, it either or. You can cook the squash, like I said, just putting it in the oven and cooking it until it's soft. And then just cut off the top and scoop out the seeds from the inside. And then you can stuff it with anything you like different vegetables, a light sauce, beans, tofu. That's really fun, and it's a beautiful presentation. Squashes are great for stuffing, which is why they are a perfect centerpiece for Thanksgiving. Now, Thanksgiving doesn't happen until November, but something to think about. We have a red curry squash recipe at Responsible Eating and Living. It's a gorgeous looking squash. It has a great color, and it's a lot of fun to prepare and stuff and present as a centerpiece or as one of the wonderful dishes that you'll have at a Thanksgiving or any fall evening celebration dinner. Another great thing about squashes is you don't have to refrigerate them, and they last a long time. Something that we like to do, it's kind of a tradition with Gary and me, is we like to drive out to the organic farms on the east end of Long Island towards the end of summer and pick up lots of different squashes that we'll ultimately use in the fall. It's a fun thing to do, go to the farms and buy the squashes, because they tend to have a big variety of all different kinds. You don't always see them in the stores. And there really are so many, and you'll want to try them all because they're all different. I recently, I don't know how long ago it was, but I was talking about spaghetti squash. Do you remember that one? Spaghetti squash is another one. But what's fun about spaghetti squash is that it's nature's spaghetti. So spaghetti squash isn't as sweet as, say, the kombucha or the butternut squash, but when you cook it, and you scoop it out. First, you have to clean the seeds out a little bit, but the flesh is actually in the shape of spaghetti. It's spaghetti, only it's a natural food. It's a whole food. It's not a refined flour-based food. And you can use the spaghetti squash with all your favorite spaghetti sauces, a rich marinara, a pesto. You can serve it as a pasta salad, cold. There are so many things you can do with the spaghetti squash. So yeah, I like to stuff the acorn squash or the kabocha squash or the curry squash. Butternut squash is another great one. A lot of people use that in soup. But you can also make sauces from, say, a butternut squash, a cheesy kind of nacho-y looking sauce because it has a great orange color. You might blend it with some white beans, a nutritional yeast, and some miso, for example. And it can make a really creamy, yummy, rich sauce. And like I said before, what surprised me about the gumbo that I had at Luann's Wild Kitchen was how well the spicy kimchi worked with the sweet kombucha. It was something that I never really imagined. So I recommend trying that too. If you can't get to Luann's, you might experiment and pick up a spicy kimchi, or make some on your own if you're ambitious, and make a gumbo with cooked kombucha. It makes a great broth too. Kombucha is, if you blend it and mix it with water, it's just a lovely, sweet, wonderful flavor. Wonderful. And back to Riverdale. So we went to the Riverdale Vegan Cheese Shop, and this time we picked up a blue cheese by Cheese Hound. Cheese Hound, I think, makes the best vegan cheese available to date. Cheese Hound is by Lori Robin. I interviewed her on this program late last year. It was really a fun interview. But her products are not easy to find. I remember her saying that she wanted to be very careful with her products and make them the way she wanted to. And as a result, that makes distribution a little more challenging and keeps things small for the moment. But if you're looking for a great blue cheese and you're hankering for blue cheese as a vegan, you might try Cheese Hounds. I think it's called Gray Blue, actually. And it's made blue by a little spirulina in it, but it's got a great blue fit flavor. Amazing. And what I like about it is it's the part about blue cheese that you love without that extra annoying stinkiness. It's just subtle stinkiness. It's really good. Okay, folks, thanks for joining me today. I am now going to take a break and get back to healing and hydrating and resting and getting over this cold. And I wish you all good health, definitely good health. Remember, you can find me at responsibleeatingandliving.com. Send me an email at info@realmeals.org. I always love hearing from you. And have a delicious week. Bye-bye. Thank you.